This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand, welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive, and today I've actually got four stories to go with you. One of them's a two-parter, which we'll do at the same time. This, and I'll start with that one, it's interesting in the sense that this is what got me into doing history. This is what got me into being interested in being an author. All of that stuff started here. So the short version of the story goes, I was at home with Dad, and we were at the kitchen table. And I think either I was reading the paper or he was, and there was an article in there about a family, and they had a war medal, and they were, you know, working out what happened to the person that this medal was issued to. It was obviously a family member. I think they passed away overseas, and that's when I brought it up to Dad. I was like, don't we have some war medals? And he said, yeah, we went and had a dig, and we found them, and they were for, so it was Dad's mother's two brothers, one World War I, one World War II. Neither of them came home. That's kind of all we knew, is that neither of them had come home. We had the medals from the World War I guy, and we had a postcard that was sent from the World War II guy. He was captured and became a prisoner of war in Java in Indonesia. And so he sent a postcard home, you know, the usual saying, yeah, I'm okay, I'm working for money, however true that was. So that got me interested. I was like, well, let's find out more. Let's find out, you know, where these guys are, what happened to them, do they have graves, you know, all of that stuff. So I went on a bit of a research path there, went and found all this information out, had a bit of a dig, and it made me want to know more and more and more and more. One of the ideas was, I want to write a book about these two guys. It never hasn't eventuated yet. Let's be optimistic here. It may still happen. Many, many years later, after I'd written many articles for the Times Age, got pretty good at what I did. I got in touch. So these guys are from, I should say, these guys are from Australia. So in a small town called Maxville in New South Wales is where these two guys were from. So I got in touch with the newspaper over there. It was the Maxville and Nambucca Heads, something or other, and said, you know, I'm related to these two guys. I've got some information. You know, would it be okay if I wrote a couple of small articles for your paper about them? And they came back and said, yeah, go for it. So I did it and got two of my articles published in an Australian newspaper, which was very cool. So this is the two articles here. So yeah, so there were two brothers. One was older than the other, so one was in World War One. The other one wasn't old enough, but he was close to my age when he signed up for World War Two. So great respect for him for doing that. But yeah, I said unfortunately neither of them came home. So these are the very brief biographies of these two guys. So we'll start with the older brother, Frank. Frank Gossen was born in Kempsey in 1895 and lived there with his parents, four brothers and two sisters, before they moved to Maxville, where brother George was born. After leaving school, Frank worked as a labourer. When war broke out, Frank presented himself and became a member of the Australian Imperial Force in May of 1916. Basic training was in Cootamundra. This would, as the name suggests, cover the basics. Rifle and bayonet practice and lots of marching. From here, Frank went to Goulburn Camp for the remainder of his basic training. The troops were then divided up in specialised instructions in the units that they would be assigned to. For Frank, he was with the Light Trench Mortar Battery. This was an effective weapon that could be fired from the safety of a trench. This would take a further 11 weeks. On October 25th, 1916, Frank boarded HMT Ascanius in Sydney. This would be the last time he would see his native land. The troop ship made its way to England, a trip that would take 2 months. They arrived 3 days after Christmas. From here, it was straight to advanced training in Wiltshire. After just over a month here, Frank was transferred to the 33rd Battalion. It was during this time that he developed cellulitis of the leg, which required an operation, and it would be 2 months before Frank was fully recovered. On July 23rd, 1917, Frank boarded the transport at Southampton, bound for France. On arrival, he was sent to Rheims for 2 weeks and from here went on to join his battalion. The 33rd were in Belgium when France arrived, but soon marched to a camp well behind enemy lines in France for rest and training. At this time, they were well supplied. On one August night, they could have had boiled meat, mashed vegetables, onion sauce, boiled rice and raisins and biscuits for tea or dinner. After marching to several other camps and even more training, the battalion arrived in the front on September 29. The area they sent to was an unknown and unpronounceable place to the men at the time, but it would never be forgotten by those that came after. Passchendaele. Frank was a scout at this time, so his job was to run ahead of his battalion and check for dangers. The German artillery was at this time incessant. On the night of October 13, Frank had settled in a shell crater to try and get some sleep. A shell landed next to him and he was buried in the explosion. He was killed instantly. He'd been at the front for just 2 weeks before his life was cut so tragically short. So we mentioned George, so he was the younger one. So this is his one, completely different story. So George Gossen was born in Maxville in 1902 and was too young to join Brother Frank in the war. He was working in forestry in Gympie when the Second World War broke out. In June of 1940, at the age of 37, George signed up for service. 3 days later, he was in camp in Brisbane and was assigned to the 2nd 15th Battalion. The following month, they sailed for Darwin aboard the Zealandia, a vessel later sunk during the Japanese bombing. While stationed there, the 2nd 15 built roads and defences. On Christmas Day 1940, they embarked on the Queen Mary destined for Egypt. Arriving in February of 1941, they were sent to camp in Palestine. A month later, George was transferred to the Headquarters Guard Battalion. The Guard Battalion was comprised of older men who were used as sentries for camps and prisoners. As it was built up of older men, it had humorous nicknames like the Olds and the Bolds and the Ruthless and the Toothless. 37 is not old people. George was part of 10 Platoon and went with the headquarters of the 7th Division around the Middle East. On December 7, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and Prime Minister Curtin made the decision to withdraw his division to help protect Australia. George was going home. He boarded HMT Orchides along with a mixture of other troops. They were sailing for the Pacific when it was announced they would not be going home after all. The Dutch were in trouble in the East Indies, and as the Orchides was the fastest, it would be sailing for Java. On February 19, 1942, the men, without most of their equipment, disembarked. 2 weeks later, the Motley Group, under Brigadier Blackburn, had taken up the defensive positions of the Lualang Bridge. Within days, they had met a superior Japanese force and began a withdrawal. They were hoping to make the coast where they could be picked up and taken home. On March 12th, still some distance from the coast, they were ordered to surrender. They were rounded up by the Japanese and became prisoners. They were kept in camps in Java and remained here for a year. But the Japanese needed labour to help build the Burma-Thailand Railway, and George's group was sent. Travelling in overcrowded train carriages and steamers, they eventually arrived in Thailand. They were to endure unimaginable horrors and treatment during this time. George, like many others, became sick and was sent to a makeshift hospital at Chiang Kai. With no medical supplies or adequate shelter, George succumbed to his illness and died on June 15. He was one of the 2,815 Australians to lose their lives during the building of the railway. Well, on that note, so that's where all my interest in this comes from. It's also where the name of my, I guess you'd call it a publishing company, production company, the Gossen Publishing. It's because of those two guys. So it's a tribute to them. So I'm going to play a piece of music now. So unfortunately, yeah, there was some other sad news this last week. A friend of mine had a family thing happen. So thinking of him, I thought, well, what do I do? I play music for people for good reasons and for other reasons. So I'm going to play one of his favorite pieces of music. I'm going to reiterate that this is his favorite piece of music, not one of mine. But as a tribute, I say, well, I'm going to play this one for you. So this is one of his favorite artists, one of his favorite songs. This is The Saga Begins by Weird Al Yankovic.
A long, long time ago, in a galaxy far away, Naboo was under an attack. And I thought me and Qui-Gon Jinn could talk the Federation into maybe cutting them a little slack. But their response, it didn't thrill us. They locked the doors and tried to kill us. We escaped from that gas, then met Jar Jar and Boss Nass. We took a bongo from the scene and we went to feed to see the Queen. We all wound up on Tatooine. That's where we found this boy. Oh my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Did you know this junkyard slave isn't even old enough to shave? But he can use the force, they say. Do you see him hitting on the queen? Though he's just 9 and she's 14. Yeah, he's probably gonna marry her someday. C-3PO, and I've heard how fast his pod can go, and we were broke, it's true, so we made a wager or two. Ooh, he was a prepubescent flying ace, and the minute Jabba started off that race, well, I knew who would win first place. Oh yes, it was. Jedi. Now we finally got to Coruscant, the Jedi Council we knew would want to see how good the boy could be. So we took him there and we told the tale how his midichlorians were off the scale. Could he bring balance to the force? They interviewed the kid. Oh, training they forbid. Because Yoda sensed in him much fear. And Qui-Gon said, now listen here. Just stick it in your pointy ear. I still will teach this boy. He was singing, my, my, this here Anakin guy. Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. We caught a ride back to Naboo, 'cause Queen Amidala wanted to. I frankly would have liked to stay. We all fought in that epic war, and it wasn't long at all before little Hotshot flew his plane and saved the day. In the end, some Gungans died, some ships blew up and some pilots fried. A lot of folks were croaking, the battle droids were broken. And the Jedi I admire most met up with Darth Maul and now he's toast. Well, I'm still here and he's a ghost. I guess I'll train this boy. And I was singing, my, my, this here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. Soon I'm gonna be a Jedi. We were singing, my, my, here Anakin guy. Maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. He left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying soon I'm gonna be a Jedi.
And there you go. Right, next story. This is completely different now. On the night of July 24th, 1939, residents of Masterton were turning in for the night when a clap of thunder roared overhead. This was followed by a severe hailstorm and strong winds. As the night progressed, the wind died down and the hail subsided, but the weather wasn't through with its assault on the region. As the people rose the next morning, they found the town covered by a blanket of cold white snow. Masterton wasn't the only one affected. In Carterton, the snow was still falling at 10 a.m. The settlements around the area were also experiencing snow. The trees and hedges are, and as far as the eye can see, is white, a farmer from Blair Logie said. Sheep and cattle were finding the conditions tricky, but luckily it was still before lambing season, so there were no young woolly creatures trying to survive in the freezing conditions. While it was not pleasant for the animals, the children of Whited Upper were delighted. This was the perfect opportunity to build a snowman, or better yet, have a snowball fight, which resulted in hordes of soggy children heading off to school. At 9 a.m. a breeze rose up, and with it the snow began to disappear. The snowmen melted, and the children dried out. The snow had gone, but the weather continued to be bitterly cold. The Corker Corner Shop on Queen Street adjusted their advertisements accordingly. Gee, it's so cold. Yes, my fingers are too cold to even roll a cigarette. Well, don't go without your smoke. Oh no, smoke a pipe. Just 2 days after the first snowfall, the region experienced another. This time, it was heavier. Residents awoke this morning to find the countryside, as far as the eye could see, under a white blanket. At an early hour, the effect was most picturesque, but a strong wind sprang up and dislodged snow from trees and shrubs. A feature of the storm was the peculiar green-coloured lightning seen in the south between 6 and 7 this morning, the Times Age reported. Travelling the streets became quite hazardous, not because of the snow underfoot, but the snow that would travel horizontally at great speed. It seemed everybody wanted to get involved in the great Masterton snow fight, with reports of combatants raging from the very young to the old. Defensive positions were taken up on the streets, and strategic high ground on the roofs of buildings was captured, and from it to rain down a barrage below. Cars attempted to traverse the streets, their wheels causing deep furrows, through which followed grateful cyclists travelling in the convenient grooves. Cars which had parked on the sides of the road found it difficult to drive up the gentle slopes of the roadside, with council doing their best to clear the roads. Whether due to the difficulty of making the journey or just because it was such a great opportunity for fun that couldn't be missed, attendance at Masterton schools that day was very low. Masterton Central School reported that just half of its students had shown up. The depth of the snow that had fallen was so severe that the clock on the post office had its hand stuck at 2:25 a.m. due to the weight of the snow on them. While there was celebration amongst children and playful adults in the towns, the farmers were concerned about this second fall of snow and the effect it would have on their animals, who couldn't find easy food as the grassy paddocks were now all under snow. It was the worst snowfall since the 1918 snowfall, which had left much of the region buried. The following day brought no new snow, and the clean-up continued. Some of the telephone and electricity lines had been cut, but were quickly repaired, which included the replacement of some poles. The people fared better, the only complaints being sore eyes, which was put down to the reflection of the sun against the white snow, and that many residents are feeling rather stiff today after yesterday's snowballing. Right, so I've got to play another piece here. So it was only a couple of days ago we had some sad news that the great Welsh singer Bonnie Tyler passed away. She was 75. We're going to play her most famous song, of course. And, you know, she was planning to go out, and when she was going to get better, she was going to tour again. So, amazing, amazing woman, and awesome that she's Welsh. So here is Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit lonely, and you're never coming around.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of my tears.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all the years have gone by.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little the look in your eyes. I can do a total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Great Bonnie Tyler. And if you've ever seen the music video, that's a weird music video. I still don't quite know what's going on with that one, but awesome song, awesome voice. On to our last one already, our last story already. Bodybuilding was in its zenith in the 1980s. A Schwarzenegger action film could always be counted on to feature a shirtless montage somewhere. So when the opportunity came for Marsden residents to see a Mr. Universe champion at their local gym, they jumped at the opportunity. Nordin Zuareg had the most un-bodybuilder-like childhood you could imagine. He was born at just 2 pounds and was a very sickly child. He first met the world as a poor mother gave birth to him on the back of an army truck in Algeria. He remained sickly for most of his childhood and his family moved to France to try and improve his health. Along with 13 siblings, he lived in the suburbs of Paris and was an easy target for bullies due to his health and small size. He had aspirations of becoming a gymnast, but after breaking his wrists, he changed his goals and turned his attention to bodybuilding. Through sheer determination and Herculean effort, the small, sickly boy completely transformed his physique. In 1985, he competed in the Mr. France Bodybuilding Championship and won the title. The following year, he set his sights higher and added the titles of Mr. Europe, Mr. World, and Mr. Universe. The latter, perhaps better known as having been won by a young Arnold Schwarzenegger in 1968, 1969, and 1970. Nordin took out the title of Mr. Universe for a second time in 1988, the same year in which he went on a world tour which would bring him to our shores. On August 11, Nordin Zuareg walked into Marsden Gym La Physique to demonstrate some bodybuilding techniques and answer some questions from the public. For those that were considering taking up the craft, Nordin shared some interesting facts. He stated that when he started as a bodybuilder at the age of 20, he was just 55 kilograms. But within 2 years of starting to lift weights, he was runner-up at the Mr. World contest. To get successful, you must see yourself as successful, he said. He also shed some light on the career of a bodybuilder, highlighting the shortness of it. The expected career length of a top bodybuilder is 10 years. Now, aged 25, he was already halfway through his career and had added some impressive titles. Now charging between $1,000 and $2,000 to appear at gyms around the world to share his experience, the Frenchman was doing well, but it was hard-earned with untold hours of toiling with weights in gyms. His opinion of New Zealand, that we were still a bit behind the times. He said he felt the Kiwi gymnasiums were 10 years behind the rest of the world, and that in some of the gyms overseas, he could be training with as many as 400 other enthusiasts. Nothing like what a gym here is like even today. The crowd at La Physique were rather subdued and not many questions were asked. Gym owner Dave Green summed this up. It's a pity they weren't more vocal, but they must have been a little overawed. From Marsden, Nordin was off to Wellington where he was to give a seminar on bodybuilding techniques at a nightclub and was also reported as giving a musical routine. After his New Zealand tour, Zuareg continued to compete in the bodybuilding world, and then, true to his word, he moved away from bodybuilding and became a fitness instructor at Miraval Life Balance Resort and Spa in Arizona. He's also written 3 books on weight loss, health, and mental health, and today gives motivational speeches on those topics. Well, our last piece of music today, I didn't come across this. YouTube did it for me. I sometimes come in early and I do my writing, whatever it is, and I'll have my headphones on and I'll play some of my soundtracky stuff in the background. And, you know, YouTube, when you finish a track, if you leave it, it'll play your next one and it'll sometimes pick ones that you might like. Doesn't always get it right, but this time it did. So I was going to play the same piece of music that it played me. Thank you, YouTube. This is from the 1917 Tron soundtrack. I think I played it before. It's a very haunting piece of music. It is called Come Back to Us. Thank you. Back to Us from the 1917 soundtrack. Brilliant movie. I sat and watched that as a sort of a military historian type and tried to pick holes in it, and it was hard to do. It's actually quite an accurate film and innovative how it basically looks like one big long shot. I mean, there's clever ways of cutting it, but you can't tell. So, yes. So that's us done for another week. So we will catch up with you again on Monday. Things are getting colder now. There was a brutal frost this morning. It was fun riding to work, seeing all the grass white and people out there with their little jugs of water pouring it over their windscreens, trying to get rid of all the ice and everything. Yeah, it's winter. It's definitely winter now. It's a good time to be indoors with the heater going, writing a book. I'll tell you that much. So that's my plan for the winter is to write and complete books now. There's plural. I've had chats with people and the consensus is that, and this is no great dig, but a lot of kids these days don't necessarily want to read a 300 to 350 page book on one historical subject. So I decided that I'm going to do a condensed version of my book on the prisoner of war camp in Featherston. So there's going to be the main one, I'm working it out. It's going to be probably around 300, lots of photos and stuff as well, not just text. It's all the good stuff that I normally put into my productions, but we're also going to do a much more condensed version, maybe 80 pages or something, so that they can put that into schools and, you know, younger people can learn about this part of our history and all the background, everything that happened, you know, all of the details, just with a lot less words. So that's my plan for the winter, is to write those two, is to get them finished and knocked out as well. And then, of course, there's all the editing and everything afterwards, but we can do that in the summer. That's fine. That's the ones where you can actually say, well, I've finished my bit. I'll give this to my friend. You go through and read it and see if you can find any mistakes, and I will fix them my end. But the main writing part, yep, that's my winter. That's what I plan on doing. It's a good time to do it. So that's us done for another week. So we will catch up with you again on Monday. At least it's not raining, touch wood, at the moment. So, yes, look after yourselves, stay warm, stay dry, and we will see you then. Catch you later.